This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Over the past year, three of Woods Hole's flagship research centers have hired new leaders. Today, we're getting to know them. We started with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and now it's MBL's turn. Huntington Willard is president and director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Before coming to Woods Hole, he served as vice chancellor for genome sciences at Duke University Medical Center and founding director of the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. Huntington Willard, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, you grew up in Belmont, Massachusetts, went to Harvard as an undergrad, and then you've worked all over the country and even in Canada. Does this feel like a bit of a homecoming?
I would answer yes until I found winter. That really reminded me I was coming home last year. But yes, it is.
And last winter was a particularly brutal reminder of what winter can be.
Indeed.
I understand that in addition to your role as president and director, you also have a faculty appointment with the University of Chicago in the Department of Human Genetics. Will you continue to have your own research group?
No, I made that decision some time ago, that shortly before coming to Woods Hole, that the contributions that I thought I could make were best if I was leading larger groups of individuals in their efforts. I had had my shot for three decades running my own research group, and I'm very proud of the people who were trained coming through my laboratory and are now set up in their own programs, both in the United States and, as you said, in Canada. So this is a time for another adventure and a very different kind of a challenge, but one that I'm very much enjoying and looking forward to.
How much contact had you had with MBL before coming here?
To be honest, I mean, as you know, in New England, there are people growing up in Boston who are lake people and look north, and there are, there's ocean people who look south, and we were one of those lake families. So I spent most of my time going north rather than towards the Cape. Always knew the MBL was here, had been down here for a few meetings at the National Academy of Sciences just up the road. So I certainly was aware of it, and I'm delighted to be here.
But certainly a really new venture for you.
Very much so, and very much allowing me to get back to my original intellectual roots as a biologist, just thinking about biology and the fascination of biology and what we can learn from it. And that, of course, is exactly what MBL was founded to do 127 years ago.
In 2003, you founded the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. That was the same year, actually, that the Human Genome Project was declared complete. What was your vision for that center?
So that was a very different time, but also quite similar in the sense that it was a moment of tremendous biological discovery. For the first time, allowing us to look at the genetic code for not just the human species, but for any species, and use that as a point of departure, a leaping off point, if you will, for finding out not only the biology, the details of the biology that we understood or thought we understood, but more interestingly, from my vantage point, new biology, things we couldn't possibly have even imagined, peering into a black box and trying to figure out what nature was trying to tell us. So that, for me, was the fascination of it. But particularly in the case of the human genome, every time a new discovery was made, we were very quickly going to run into the kinds of societal and social issues that needed to be dealt with, both on a personal level and for the communities around us. So the bold thought that we had at Duke was to bring those two together and to do the scientific discovery simultaneously with and adjacent to those who immediately had to think about what the implications might be for those findings.
Do you feel that those kinds of ethical and societal issues have been dealt with, or are those things that we are still continuing to wrestle with?
We were, not surprisingly, I think, terribly naive, both about how much new science would appear, as well as how to grapple with the societal and personal questions that would come up. So I think we, both at Duke and in the broader field in general, have done a good job in teeing up those questions. One could argue that in 2003, 2005, 2007, it was almost too early. We could tee up the questions, we could put them on a list, but we really had no idea how to really grapple with them.
The science hadn't quite gotten there yet,
right,
to really let it play
there,
out.
And the way we think about it, people just couldn't wrap their head around some of the issues that were coming up. And yet now, with now a decade of thinking and rethinking some of those issues, we're probably in a much better position now to deal with those. But I say that knowing full well that there'll be other questions that no one could possibly have anticipated a decade ago that'll come up a decade from now. That's the nature of science and its impact on the world that we live in.
You mentioned the broad naivete about how much new science would be produced and its impact. I don't think those in the Human Genome Project ever actually said this, but somehow the story as it went through, you know, the game of telephone through the media and out into the public seemed to get translated into something to the effect of, we're going to sequence the human genome and within 10 years we will have cured all diseases. Was the Human Genome Project oversold? Has it lived up to the expectations, at least of the scientific community, if not the general public?
So those are two different halves to the question, and I'm going to separate those. So I don't think it was oversold. I think, in fact, if you ignored what you said about the timeline, that in fact the Human Genome Project has done spectacularly well and will continue to do spectacularly well in informing us about ourselves as a species, where we came from, where we're going. And yes, indeed, that will have an enormous impact on both the precision and the ability to translate that into findings in healthcare and in medicine.
Can you give an example of something that has? I mean, it's a short timeline for science to say, you know, 10 or so years later, but are there examples at this point of major breakthroughs, major understanding in human conditions that have come from the Human Genome Project?
I think so, and the timeline is short. The average, if you look at it going back over the past 50 years of biomedical research advances, it often takes an average of 17 to 20 years for any research discovery to find its way into the clinic. So it's actually quite dramatic that there are some that within a decade were finding a place in hospital care and healthcare. The most obvious example is in cancer. The recognition and the ability to have the tools to begin to look at individual cancers and treat them as individual cancers. And we've always said in medical education, we have said, oncologists have said it, if you've met one case of cancer, you've met one case of cancer. And you have to. So it really was the perfect case where you might be able to look in and expect to find and develop tools where you could react to what a particular individual had and how one should approach, manage that condition, hopefully treat that condition, and prevent its recurrence. So cancer is the best example of that. Every cancer, every tumor has unique genomes that are different from every other patient with that same disorder. So it really is tailor-made for that approach.
When you're at MBL, there's a much broader swath of biological sciences that you're now leading. What's applicable from what you've been doing at Duke and in the area of genome sciences and this policy that you bring to leading the MBL now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, many of my colleagues asked it a little less politely than you put it. Were asking me, what was I doing? A career human geneticist by training and working on human genome and suddenly going to a place that works on everything except human for most of the time. And my answer was always the same, that the last time I checked, every organism that we study has a genome. And if we didn't understand the human genome very well, good heavens, imagine the discoveries that we can make by uncovering genomes from the host of other organisms and species, most of which we don't even know anything about, and we haven't found them enough in order to label them new species. I mean, the estimates are that the largest proportion of undiscovered species lie in the oceans. And in fact, those are both opportunities, sort of cauldrons for discovery of new biology, new pathways that I can't even articulate because by definition, we don't know them yet. But also as the sort of canaries in the mine, the sentinels that tell us something about ocean health and climate change more generally, and that will begin to tell us, as they already are, where we're finding differences and stresses and strains in the ecosystems.
When you're working in human genetics, even if your goal is not to solve some health problem, you're really only a step or two away from that potential application of your research. Here at the Marine Biological Laboratory, you know, working on ocean microbes or squid or all of these other things, there's maybe a case that could be made for some application of that research, but a lot of it is just basic curiosity-driven research, especially in this day and age with such restricted science funding. How important is that basic research and how do you make that case?
Yeah, well, so I would push back. I would push back on a couple of different things you just said. First of all, I think even in the human, studying the human as an organism, the number of dots that one has to connect looking forward to translate that into, quote, useful, unquote, discoveries is actually very, very long. We can often state it much more crisply than that and make it sound like it's just around the corner, but the reality is very different. One of the things that is easier to do with other organisms than it is to do in the human is to do a phrase that I often use with my students, which is to freely confess our ignorance. And we don't like to do that very much when we talk about ourselves. And yet it is the rest of biology, the rest of nature, invites us to do that. And we should be clear, the MBL has always been, and I think always should remain, a fundamental biology discovery institution. We are delighted when our discoveries can make an impact on the world around us, but in reality, we don't understand the world at all. And so we need institutions, and the MBL is very proud to be one of those that is focused on fundamental biology discoveries for discovery's sake, driven by the curiosity to find what we don't yet know, and yet make the best of those in order to tell us the both about the past and the future of nature and its organisms. So that is our fundamental center of gravity. And yes, we like to connect it to what we know about the world, but the science of climate change is what drives us. We're aware of the policy implications of it, but what drives us is the science of climate change, to understand what's happening, to understand the impact on organisms, and understand how organisms, from their genome to their behavior, do in fact react to a changing environment and the threat that's around them all the time.
A few years ago, it became public knowledge that the MBL was facing significant financial problems, a large operating deficit. How much better off is the MBL today than it was a few years ago?
So our connection to the University of Chicago has been a spectacular lifeline, but much more than a lifeline. It's given us an intellectual community of colleagues who are superb, both at the university itself and with its other affiliates like the Argonne National Laboratory and even the Fermi Institute. Those opportunities allow us to think in a much more expansive and forward-looking way than the MBL could when it was struggling, as you alluded to. So whereas our bottom line may or may not have changed terribly much in a very short period of time, I think the outlook has changed enormously. What that has bought us is the ability to look a decade ahead, to think a decade or two ahead in terms of what the scientific opportunities are, what the educational opportunities are, and how we want to be distinctive. Survival is no longer our goal. Sustainability is a goal, and having a dramatic and unique impact on the biology and research and education around the world for decades and decades to come.
You already alluded to the fact that one of MBL's historic strengths is collaboration, bringing people from very different backgrounds together, especially during the summer when there are so many people here. And actually, there's a recently established award system to actually fund collaboration explicitly between MBL, the University of Chicago, and Argonne National Lab, as you just mentioned. What is the need for that direct funding for collaboration that's not being met by other funding streams within science?
So it is, as you say, it's a difficult funding landscape in biological and biomedical science right now. And most scientists love to collaborate because they find the intellectual complementarity, reaching out, if I can confess my ignorance to you and you can confess your ignorance back, we can find something that we can teach each other and do something better together than we could possibly have done separately. But you're right, very few places are funding that at the very earliest stages. So we need to catalyze that and give people the license, if you will, to enter into a discussion about a collaboration that they otherwise might be inclined to say in difficult times, as we have in this country and around the world for research, to say, boy, I'm really too busy now. I've got to take care of these other lines of activity that I already have funding for. I can't think of something new. So we're trying to provide that catalyst, if you will, both with the research programs and research awards that we now have and others that we hope to be developing in the future as we attract our own funding around our strategic plan and the launch of the new age or a new age for the MBL. I mean, the MBL is so old that you, in fact, can have a new age every 25 years. So, so I have to be careful of calling it the new age, but it is the next new age for the MBL. And our most obvious and some of our most committed colleagues and collaborations will come from people in Chicago and Argonne because they already are, it's sort of like when you marry into a family. It's no guarantee that those are going to be your best friends, but you might as well spend a lot of time and effort because there's a shared commitment to do things together. And so far, that's been working beautifully, and I'm sure it'll continue to in the years ahead.
Huntington Willard is president and director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Hunt, thank you.
Thank you.
Last but not least, the new president and executive director of Woods Hole Research Center, on that organization's role in addressing the scientific and social challenges of climate change. That's coming up after a short break. Stay with us.